From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And I have probably said that 500 times. I don't know what show we're on, Scott, but I think it's like 400 or 500 shows so far. We've interviewed I don't know how many entrepreneurs, but today we get to interview and have a discussion with John Finnegan. He is the founder and CEO of Beck Ag. He is also an entrepreneurial guy that I've known for since I've started the show. He was part of the Entrepreneurs Organization, which really, I would say in a big way, prompted me to want to do this show, right? To do my part for entrepreneurs in the Sacramento region. And by joining EO, I was sort of awakened to this idea of entrepreneurs helping other entrepreneurs. And John was one of the first people I met when I came into EO. He's quite a guy. I think you're going to enjoy his story. But I think that that's one thing that this show hopefully does, and that the Entrepreneurs Organization does for so many entrepreneurs. It makes us feel just a little bit less alone, because solitude can be the death of an entrepreneur. And when you're out there trying to build a business, and it can be a little bit of a lonely feeling. My brother and I built our businesses, and we had each other. And when we ended up with, you know, hundreds of employees and teammates that kept us from really feeling alone. So, in our, you know, we built our business all over the country. But after selling the businesses, then I launched out more alone because he retired. And now I knew what it was like to be working to build something alone. And I joined the Entrepreneurs Organization and didn't feel quite so alone. And seeing what good the Entrepreneurs Organization does for the broader community led me to want to help the broader community in terms of entrepreneurship. And one of the things John says on today's show that I think is impactful, I asked him a question about his values and have they changed since he started his company? And he said, "Your core values never change, Mark." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right." Well, the core value that I respect from the Entrepreneurs Organization so much is to boldly go, right? That's one of the mantras of the Entrepreneurs Organization, to go boldly. And I think that that's a big part of succeeding in entrepreneurship is you got to go out there and take a risk. And sometimes you're afraid, but you got to do it and you got to go boldly. And so, again, stick around. Listen to the story of John Finnegan. You'll meet a real world entrepreneur. And then at the end of the show, I will talk a little bit more about core values and one specific core value that's very important to me. So stick around, my friends.
Entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy. They take the risks, create the opportunities, and move the molecules. Now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
And now it is my pleasure to bring on John Finnegan. I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time, John. And, you know, this is going to be one of those shows where you and I have probably known each other, I don't know, 8 years, something like that, through the Entrepreneurs Organization. And, you know, you're one of those, you're the epitome of an entrepreneur. So today we're going to share your story. You're this, you know, guy that's done so many things in his life, including entrepreneurship. So I want to make sure we kind of interweave your personal story with the story of Beck Ag. You're the founder of Beck Ag. So maybe start off telling us your journey into entrepreneurship. How did you become an entrepreneur?
Well, I didn't come out of the womb as an entrepreneur.
Oh, I heard you did.
I actually, so after I graduated with a degree in agriculture from Penn State, they had a Peace Corps recruiter on campus in my senior year. And I was always wanting to give back. I just felt like, you know, I kind of won the lottery based on where I grew up, where I lived, the parents that I had.
Where did you grow up? I forgot.
Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so I knew you were just outside of Philly. You know, a Philadelphia Eagles fan. And I like everything about you almost.
Yeah. Yeah, tough day on Sunday. They got a good future ahead.
Oh, yes.
But, yeah, so I ended up going into the Peace Corps after college. I graduated in May, and I was in the Philippines by late June of that year. So that was quite an experience. 2 years in the Philippines. I was teaching agriculture to college students there, La Union province, which was about 6 hours north of Manila. Actually, you could probably drive it in 2 hours on good roads, but it was kind of rough. But it was a great experience I would encourage every American to spend some time overseas to kind of see really how good we have it. Because I think I took that for granted for a lot of my early years, and the experience in the Philippines really opened my eyes to we really have it good here in this country, and it's better than, you know, 95% of the rest of the world. So
yeah.
So then I came back from the Philippines, and a buddy of mine was like, you need to get a job in agriculture, you know, because you're all about ag. That was your education. And he goes, I've been working for this company, and basically it was a crop protection company. And we just go around and do meetings with farmers, and we teach them about our products and new innovative technology and stuff. So I applied to Chevron. And believe it or not, Chevron Oil Company used to be in the ag business.
Really?
Ortho was their brand.
Oh, you know, gotcha.
Big home and garden products company. But they also sold products to farmers. And anyway, I applied. They were looking for a master's degree person. I only have a BS in agriculture. But the Peace Corps experience actually picked the interest of the guy who was hiring. And I went down to Winchester, Virginia, which was their regional office, interviewed. And he was like, yeah, we're really looking for a master's person for this job because it's very technical. It's technical sales. But this Peace Corps thing really caught my eye. So tell me about that. So basically, we talked about that, and I got hired the next day.
Nice.
So started out in Richmond, Virginia, covered half the state of Virginia for Chevron. And then probably 4 or 5 years later, I moved up the chain, and I was in product management in San Francisco, 575 Market Street. What a difference that was from, you know, walking fields with farmers and everything to being in the big city of San Francisco. But working for a huge company like that, I learned so much. I have nothing bad to say about Chevron. Were they perfect? Did they do everything right? Did they, no. But I think that informed me for the future, because I don't think I could have been a good business owner or entrepreneur in my 20s or 30s. Without that experience that I learned from them.
So let's talk about that for a second here. It's taken a while to get to your entrepreneurial experience, but that's okay, because I want to have this be somewhat educational as well. Why is it good to go to work for a big company, and what experience do you learn in a big company that helps you for entrepreneurship?
I think in addition to the things to do, if I ever get out on my own, I'm going to do this, but also things not to do, ways not to treat people.
You can learn a lot from, every experience. But like, I remember thinking that, like, as a sports guy, right? You got a coach that maybe you don't like as much. You still learn a lot.
Yeah. It wasn't so much that. It was, there's a lot of politics involved in big corporations. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bureaucracy. Every decision, like my expense report, had to go up to the executive committee for approval. It's like, man, this is not a way to run an efficient, you know, effective business. And I think that gave me the real idea to kind of branch out on my own.
Okay.
And then, so I was, fast forward from the time in San Francisco, I moved to DC for a few years. And even though I'm a sales and marketing guy, in Washington, I was the registration manager. So I had to deal with EPA. And if you're a results-oriented person, dealing with a government bureaucracy is like 10 times worse and more difficult than dealing with a big company.
So Chevron is 10 times better than the federal government in terms of bureaucracy. Okay, that's good to know. So, and then where does entrepreneurship? Okay, is that 10 times better than Chevron?
Yeah. So after 3 years of banging my head against EPA, and I actually got a couple products registered, and one of the products, which was a selective grass herbicide for corn and soy or for soybeans, got that registered. And then I called our VP of sales and I said, hey, next time you got a sales region that's open, I want to get the heck out of Washington. I want to manage the sales region. So shortly after that, this was probably around 1990, moved to Chicago. I had 13 states that I was responsible for, a bunch of sales reps that I was managing, and actually got to sell the product that I had registered, which was awesome. And then after 6 years of doing that, I got a call from our CEO. He said, we want to move you to Walnut Creek, where the company was based then, as our VP of marketing. And that was the time, right around that same time, I had met a guy by the name of Charlie Beck. So that's the Beck in Beck Ag. And Charlie's company was called C. Beck and Associates. They would do these peer influence programs, experience sharing, in the medical and pharmaceutical industry, where doctors would learn from each other. And they would, you know, you'd have maybe a group on a teleconference where you'd have a couple doctors who were big prescribers of the drug, let's say it's a cholesterol lowering drug, and they would share their experiences and the financials and everything with kind of like EO in a way, you know, the experience sharing. So he was telling me about how, or when I learned about what he was doing, we met for lunch. And I was like, hey, Charlie, do you want to expand? Do you want to diversify your business? Because I could do this, what you're doing in the pharmaceutical industry, I could do it in agriculture. A lot of parallels between doctors. You know, doctors prescribe drugs to patients. Farmers prescribe seeds or fertilizer. You know, it's kind of prescriptive on acres. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of parallels there. And, you know, farmers feel that their peers are credible, right? Instead of having a sales rep from the company trying to tell right. them how wonderful their product is, hearing it from another farmer is way more credible.
All right, let's talk about entrepreneurship here. We've been talking about your career for a long time now. Let's jump into like what it's like to be an entrepreneur. Let's, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road, right? So you're working for, you start Beck Ag within this company. And then when did you break off onto your own?
So late 96, formed the business plan for Beck Ag in conjunction with Charlie. He kind of capitalized the business initially. And then I made the call to Walnut Creek and told our CEO that I wasn't going to accept the VP of marketing job, and I was moving on to start my own company, which he thought was crazy. So in the very beginning of 97 was when we first started operating as a business.
So 97 is called Beck Ag. Mm-hmm. And today, what does that company look like?
Well, one quick thing. So the transition from working for a big company to being an entrepreneur. I mean, when I would call customers, you know, when I was a big regional sales manager, people answered my call because they knew that, hey, I might be able to give them a discount or help them out with a problem. When I ended up starting Beck Ag, it was like, John, who is this? You know, I was like, oh, it was tough, right? Because nobody nobody knew Beck Ag. We had to kind of start from the very
beginning. You had to sell. Good job.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no problem or sales. So, I mean, I think anybody that just starts a business deals with, oh, crap, I don't have enough customers or I don't have any customers. So welcome to the real world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we grew and our 95% of our business was doing these peer-to-peer experience sharing programs. We worked with most of the major seed companies and fertilizer companies, equipment, you know, the John Deere's, the Case IH's, crop protection companies. Monsanto was actually our first and biggest client. And what we did for them, they were introducing in 97 Roundup Ready soybeans, which was kind of the first genetically modified soybeans. So, which was a tremendous advancement in ag.
Well, let's talk about what your company looks like today, and then we'll hit some key highlights and some turning points along the way. But I just want people to know what you're doing today.
Sure.
And then we'll dive in and dissect the key turning points, and we'll try to weave in some of the life lessons through that.
Yeah, so today we have 30 employees, W-2 employees. We have probably 40 1099 contract folks that work for us. We're a virtual company, remote first. I mean, we have a couple offices in Wayne, Nebraska, and then one in Charlotte, North Carolina. But really, from the very beginning, we started as a virtual company. And I just didn't see a need to, you know, have a home office somewhere, which limits the people that you can recruit to your company. If you have to have people move to Des Moines, Iowa, or to Chicago, that is already an initial screening for who you can recruit. So the really crazy good thing about being virtual is no limitations on who we could recruit. And it was actually a big advantage to be able to recruit really good, high quality, professional, seasoned people that had experience in the business. And their only issue was, get me off of an airplane. I don't want to keep going to an office. And, you know, if you allow me to work at home, I will give you, you know.
You know, much of the world, has this discovered that through the pandemic, sadly, when you've discovered it prior. Okay, so what problem is your business solving? What do you do for your customer?
Well, really, sales and marketing was our sweet spot up to about 5 years ago. That was pretty much the only thing we did. So we helped companies to drive adoption of mostly new products. I mean, 90% of our business.
How do you do it?
Again, I'm going to talk about up to about 2019, and then there was a big transformation that occurred. But up to 2019, almost 100% of our business was putting together what we call experience exchange panels, which were mostly done over the telephone, where we would recruit farmers for a conference call, basically, and they would learn from each other about the sponsor, you know, the company that was paying for that.
So John Deere, or a major person in ag, the deeper pockets people that have the product sponsor the webinar, if you will, or this conference call. And so then there was you took a spread on that. You took some of that marketing money.
Got
it. And then you scaled that up nationally. You got people all over the country doing this. Okay. And then go ahead.
You used the word webinar, and here's something that I learned early on. Because think about it. When we started in the late 90s, you know, the internet was just coming on board, and everybody was telling me, because we were doing these conference calls, you know, simple technology. Phone rings, farmer picks it up, hello, and you're on, right? So everybody was saying, oh, you need to do these by webinar because, you know, you can use cool graphics and everything and people can see each other and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we tried that. I'm not a Luddite in terms of technology. We tried that. But the problem is that if you have a great conversation going, you're hearing passion in one of the farmer's voices talking about how this product really worked for him. And then let's say you're doing it as a webinar. then you hear, you know, right in the middle of the real meat that you're talking about, you hear, well, that's not what I'm seeing on my screen. Oh, man, then we're dealing with technology problems instead of the product that we're talking about. Yeah. So we decided to keep it mostly via telephone. And I mean, nowadays, 95% of it is mobile phones. You know, the farmers are.
Well, you said 2 years ago there was a change. What happened?
So in 2019, I hired a new CEO. He came aboard from a company called Ag Data, which was doing. One of the things that's huge in agriculture is fulfillment, marketing program fulfillment. So companies like seed companies, fertilizer, crop protection companies, they rebate a lot to both the dealers and to the farmers. So those transactions, they involve billions of dollars of transactions to the dealers and the farmers. So Ag Data and another company had 99% of that business. And that business is the transactions, the marketing program rebate fulfillment.
Is that like co-op marketing spend where you get a little bit by because you bought a bunch of this type of product as a dealer, they give you a percent or two to go to marketing spend?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Or it's discounts on the product.
But they can use that discount to go spend it on marketing.
So I brought Richard on board. He recruited some of his team from Ag Data. And the transformation that we've done is really to a much more sophisticated CRM platform that we have that we, you know, I would say that for our marketplace, for our industry, for agriculture, because we started out with Salesforce.com and we have a hybrid platform or CRM platform now it's better than Salesforce. we still work with Salesforce. That's kind of the underpinning foundation of our CRM platform. So we've got that in terms of our data assets. We over the years have developed a very robust and up-to-date data warehouse, which we call AgIQ. That's our and think about it. If we're trying to reach farmers and engage them, I mean, there's a couple million farmers in the U.S. And I would say that over 26 years now that we've been calling them and talking with them, it's enabled us to really keep that data up to date. So we have the most predictive. And when I say predictive data, I mean, we're able to let's say we're working on a fungicide product for BASF, for example, one of our clients. We're able to identify who are the likely farmers that are going to need this product. And that helps us to reduce our cost on recruitment. But it also increases the return on investment for our client, because if you're actually talking with the right people about the right product at the right time, you know, you're going to get a better result. So we've really upgraded our data assets, and in addition to the fulfillment. And the key with the fulfillment platform that we have, we call that FulfillXQ, is that those contracts, as I said, that, you know, there's billions of transactions that are being managed by these companies that do the marketing program fulfillments. The contracts with individual companies are multiple years, multi-million dollar contracts. So one of the things that Richard really beat into my head when he first came aboard was recurring revenues. We were often starting the year with very little, you know, maybe 10 or 15% of our forecast or budget for that year in terms of revenue. So, you know, it's like starting in the first inning every year to try to
And to our audience out there that's listening, so there are transactional type businesses, and then there are companies with recurring revenue. And that recurring revenue, it makes your company a lot more valuable. You're going to have a company that basically has orders coming in ongoing versus you got to go out and make a new sale every time. So that definitely increases the value of your company. It probably helps you sleep better at night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, got the steady business coming in. Okay, great. Sounds like that guy was a key find.
Yeah, it makes us at least a semi SaaS company in mm-hmm. the software as a service, and the margins are better in that type of business.
Okay, so we got the idea of what the business is. Let's talk about you and your life, and maybe the turning points that have happened, and maybe how that affect the business.
Yeah, we were fortunate over really from 97 to 2016, we were either steadily growing or flat, maybe a year, then we grow a year. We were on the Inc. 5000 fastest growing companies 5 or 6 times over that span. But the big problem, even from the very beginning, was we were way too dependent on 1 or 2 big clients. So, you know, concentration of business is not a good thing. So, and it really bit us in 2016. I don't know if you've ever had clients that have merged. I mean, big companies. So we had, we had millions of dollars of business that we were doing with Pioneer, a big seed company. And they, in 2015, started a merger of Dow, DuPont, Pioneer, the three coming together. Anytime huge companies come together like that in a merger, all the little guys, you know, we kind of get pushed to the side. A lot of the management in those companies, the big companies that are merging, are like, I don't even know if I'm going to have a job next year. So we're kind of freezing budgets. So the huge amount of business that we were doing with Pioneer in 2016 shrunk to almost nothing because they froze a lot of the marketing budgets. And in the beginning of 2016, we made an acquisition of a world-class company called Agribusiness Group, which was their focus area, their key, core competency was doing training programs and educational programs in the ag business. So we were adding that platform.
So you spread thinner than normal because you're biting off a new opportunity. And then all of a sudden, rug pulled out from underneath you with Pioneer. What'd you do and what lessons can we learn from it?
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the challenge with Pioneer didn't really formalize until Q3 of 2016. If I had to do it over again, I would have fired some people early in 2016. I wouldn't have made the acquisition, but because we had taken on debt for the first time in our history at that point. So anyway, by the end of the 2016, we had lost it millions of dollars, and I had such a good team that I wanted to keep them together. So here's where the personal life gets pulled into this. I had to sell my house and plow the equity in the house into the company so we could keep people mm-hmm. through 2017, so we could pay people. And I mean, we were already extending some payrolls out several weeks and even months for some of the partners. So 2017, we kicked butt. We had a tremendous year, and we weren't able to pay back all the debt. I rented a house for a year, and then in 2018, we were able to buy a new house on the same street that we had sold the first house. But
were you able to pay back the debt?
Well, the company has not paid back. Well, we're very like 10% of the total debt that we have.
Oh, congratulations!
So it was a 5-year.
You're chipping away.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing really well now, and we haven't even used our line of credit for the last 3 years. So, the crazy thing about that whole experience was, when I went in 2018 to try to buy a new house, and I was trying to get a mortgage, and the mortgage bankers were all like, looking at your, because I own 2/3 of the company, And they were looking at this loss from 2016 because you have to show 2 years of tax returns to get a mortgage. So nobody wanted to touch me. Even one of my EO buddies who was in the mortgage business, sorry, John, can't do it. So luckily, I was doing my financial management through a company called Creative Planning. And they have a relationship with some mortgage lenders. And they're like, well, we can help you out. I mean, we know where most of your assets are. So, you know, you're good. Don't worry about that. So thank God I got.
So you bought the house and so things are going well for
you. Kept the marriage.
Yeah, kept the marriage. Life is good. So let's talk about you. When you first rolled in, you had your principles. You know, you're a nostalgic person, obviously. And you had a note that had some of the guiding principles from when you started the company. Let's talk about guiding principles, how important they are. And, you know, you made a copy of them, obviously, and put it in your your book.
Yeah.
How do you decide on the guiding principles, and are they still true today?
Yeah, well, guiding principles are different than the mission and vision. The guiding principles never change, as far as I'm concerned. So, and our guiding principles are very family oriented. It's funny, Jack Crawford and I were talking about this the other day because he used the term work-life balance. And he was saying that there's no such thing, which I agree, but I never use the word work-life balance. I just use, and one of our number one guiding principles is to allow our people to have productive and balanced lives. Nothing about work, because lives means comprehensive. It's everything. So, and that was really the one main guiding principle that I wanted to stress with our people, that this is about allowing you to go to a soccer game in the middle of the day, or, you know, at the end of school day, which is still part of the work day, but it's okay to, at times, you know, have family activities that you can do.
So you've been an entrepreneur for a long time. And as you look back at your career, are there certain achievements you're most proud of?
I would say that being able to live my life and my business with integrity, and never having anyone challenge that, because, you know, I've always believed that whatever decisions that I make, whatever direction we go, I want to be able to be able to tell my kids, yeah, this is why I did this, and this is what I did, and why I did it, and not be embarrassed by that. The last thing I want to be is, you know, all about success or money or anything other than integrity. And I mean, you know that I've been involved in tons of community service and philanthropic efforts in the region, and that's important to me. I had a business valuation done several years ago. And the Chris Whitaker is the name of the evaluator. He did kind of a forensic accounting valuation of the company. And he made a comment that Mr. Finnegan is more about his legacy and about allowing others to participate in that. So the one thing that I think I was much different than many of my other EO forum mates was that most of them owned 100% of their companies and were not interested in, you know, partnerships. I, on the other hand, so Charlie and I started the business in 97. In 99, I bought him out. So I owned 100% of the business for about 10 minutes. And then I started rewarding the people that helped me to grow the business from that point on. So I now have 6 partners. And then recently, like over the last 5 years, we've done more in terms of stock options. So because some of the tax implications of ownership. But,
what kind of effect did giving a piece of action to your employees, what kind of effect did that have on the business?
Loyalty. I mean, people will fall on their sword for me and for the company. They appreciate the fact that I recognize their contribution to the company. And that's why I gave them equity in the company, because they helped me to grow the company. I didn't do it all by myself. It was a team effort, and I wanted to recognize that, and they definitely appreciate it. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have people leave because they feel that sense of loyalty, and you know, it's a real team effort.
Any advice on that you would give to other entrepreneurs about giving away part of their company to their team?
I would say consider the stock options approach versus the equity shares approach.
It's cleaner.
And it's just because of the tax issues involved with that.
Yeah. And what about decision making too? Because people with options don't have the same decision making rights that typically equity holders have.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a board that really does that. And you know, the board members all have equity stake in the business. But, you know, I mean, I don't think any of our partners or even any of our employees feel like they can't pick up the phone and weigh in or, you know, give feedback for things that they see going right or wrong or, you know, directions that they think we should take.
So what inning, if we're talking baseball here, Philadelphia Phillies, I assume you're a Phillies fan too. Okay, so if this is a baseball question, what inning are we in? We look at your entrepreneurial career. What inning is it?
I think maybe top seven.
Top of seven?
Yeah. I don't know. I probably never talked with you about the fact that shortly after I started BeckAg, I got involved with another business that was doing predictive prescription data for doctors and ended up buying into that company, owned half of that company for a few years. And then in 2012, we were acquired. So I made a nice exit with that and that's one reason why I've never felt like I needed to, you know, kind of hoard mm-hmm. all of the company. I like sharing, but I mean, I made out pretty well financially. So, you know, I wasn't in a situation where I had to you know, depend on BeckAg alone for mm-hmm. the future.
That's great. You brought up the word legacy a few minutes ago. So if you're in the seventh inning, you're beginning to think about your legacy, obviously, from a business standpoint. What do you want people to say about you when you step away?
Yeah, I think I hope that the company will continue and I can be a part of it, whether I sell out all of my shares or not. And I mean, I think a lot of them say it now that they just appreciate what I've done for them and their families. Yeah. You know, funny story though, like probably 2 years into the business, I remember having a meeting in Schaumburg, Illinois at Charlie Beck's offices. And we had maybe 10 people there at the time. And somebody brought up they used the term family for the business. And people, some of the of our shareholders now still bring up this story about, yeah, John stood up and said, "We are not a family. I just want you to understand that's the case. We're not a family. We're going to pay you really well. And if you want to go on great vacations with your family, if you want to support your families, that's cool." And part of the reason I was so animated about that was that Charlie Beck, and I think I'm the only Beck company that has survived. And part of the reason was that he mixed too much of the family stuff. Like the first meeting that I attended that was a CBEC meeting was out in Carmel at the Highlands Inn. Like families, kids, and everything came to this meeting. And I just thought, oh my gosh, that's got to cost a pretty penny. Well, sure enough, you know, over the years that kind of bit him, and he ended up.
So you've built a culture that's like a family, but this is not bring your family to work business. Okay, so we only have a few minutes left. Maybe just give me some closing thoughts on, you know, the advice to the up and coming entrepreneurs, the people that see what you've done and are inspired by it, but maybe want to maybe get some wisdom on how they might approach their career so they can have the same kind of legacy that you aspire to have.
Well, I'm going to share my superpower, even though it might, it'll probably help some people if they hear this, but my superpower is being able to ask people for help. I've always been the guy that, like, even when I was a sales rep, walking fields with farmers, I would never act like I knew it all. And I would always ask them about, you know, what they thought, or if it was a, you know, fertilizer dealer that we were trying to establish a better relationship with, I would just ask them, how can you help me? You know, 24-year-old kid, I didn't act like I knew everything. And I think people ended up feeling, maybe they felt sorry for me, but they kind of took me under their wing. And I mean, I have some of those relationships to this day from people that helped me along the way. So I would say that, you know, don't be afraid to ask people for help.
And you're a very humble person. And I take it that you probably asked in this humbling way, this way that's very humble.
I don't know most people would say that I'm that humble. I do tend to be very confident in myself and maybe a little arrogant at times, but I was never afraid to ask for help. But I remember one time, maybe I learned to not be so arrogant or confident from in college. A bunch of my buddies were working at a restaurant called the Train Station, and they're like, "Hey, John, you should get a job there. You can do whatever there." So I went in and I interviewed with the guy, and I acted like I was the biggest, baddest SOB, and he pretty much just shook his head and, I don't think you're going to work out for us. And I mean, it just knocked me back a couple pegs, and I thought, well, that's a good experience.
All right. Well, thank you, John, for coming on the show. I appreciate you sharing your story. Congratulations on all the success, and the story of perseverance is inspiring. So really appreciate everything, and great to have Sacramento entrepreneurs like you here on the show.
Yeah, man.
Thank you very much. You bet. Thanks.
Now, let's get Mark's perspective and closing thoughts from today's show. We're back to the Marquee Media Studio. It's the Mark Haney Show.
Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. Enjoyed talking to my buddy John Finnegan. He is, like I said earlier, a member of the Entrepreneurs Organization. And John is just one of those principled people. You meet him, you get what you see what you get. And, you know, those are the kind of people that I really like to put in my life. And he talked on the show about about core values and how your core values never change. And my number one core value, it hasn't changed over the years, and it's commitment. So why is it commitment? Well, quick story. I remember that we did an exercise in my old company around values and what our core values ought to be. And we listed, I don't know, close to a half a dozen core values. And they sort of got washed out because there were so many. One didn't really stand out, but except for the one, commitment. And so I went on and on about why commitment was so important to me. And we had them all written down on the wall, on this big wall, so that we could all see them. And I remember one of our teammates said, "Well, if commitment's the most important one, Mark, well, why is it mixed in the middle?" So we moved commitment up to the top. And I'll tell you why. I really think for a few reasons, commitment has been so important to me in my life. One part of commitment really lends itself to our character, We all remember that movie, Jerry Maguire. And I think if you remember, Jerry Maguire was one, it was an agent, and he was working on one big client, and it was this guy named Cush. He was the number one draft pick. And I remember Cush's dad said, "Jerry, my word is as strong as oak." And they did a big handshake over it. And you know what? Cush's dad, he broke the commitment. And that was a character issue. And so for me, commitment is as important piece of a person's character as anything. You could have all the talent in the world. You could have all the good intentions of the world. You could have all these great things about you. But if you don't have your word, if you aren't even somebody who can make a commitment, are you really somebody that I want in my life? Are you really somebody that, you're certainly not somebody I want in my inner circle. When I look at our team, and Scott and Tammy have been with me, you know, 10, 15 years plus. The Growth Factory teammates have been with me years. And I've been married 38 years-ish. It's just the way I'm built. I'm relentlessly local, and I've relied so heavily on people that could keep their commitments that I put that at the highest level. Because, I mean, if I'm going to make a commitment, I got to make sure it gets done. And so I want to put people in my life that will help me to keep my commitments, because I want to be that kind of person for others. The other thing about commitment, besides just being the right kind of person to, you know, the right kind of friend to have, is somebody who can keep their commitment. The other piece of being committed, I think a lot of people don't make commitments. I mean, we make so many commitments, right? I'm overcommitted. I'm overboarded. I'm just so, you know, my commitment gets a little bit watered down because I've made so many commitments. It's hard to keep all my commitments. And that's maybe less of a character flaw and maybe a ability to manage yourself flaw. So I think so many of us overcommit to too many things. And so one thing that has been helpful for me is making less commitments, but making more deep commitments. So I, you know, my mission statement only has, you know, my family, my friends, and community, right? I'm so focused on those commitments and helping those people that, because it's so focused, because I'm so committed to my mission, because it's limited in scope, I'm allowed to dream big because the commitments are so narrow. And that has been so helpful. And the other kind of challenge that I think I see out there, besides being overcommitted in people, is maybe the inability to make a commitment, the inability to make a decision. And there's something very freeing about making a commitment. I mean, indecision is the mother of stress. If you can't decide, or you're vacillating on a decision, or if I'm vacillating on a decision and I can't commit, that weighs on me. That's heavy. That's heavy duty stuff. And hey, who needs the stress? We don't need the stress. So make a few commitments and make them serious. Keep the commitments. I hope you do. And when I look to invest into companies or bring people into my life as business partners, the first thing I look at is, can they commit? So to all you out there figuring it out, figuring out what your core values are, mine is commitment. Of course, I have other values that are important to me, but to be in my inner circle, to be a business partner of mine, you've got to be able to keep your commitment. So to all you out there, fight the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. And to all you out there, fight the good fight for entrepreneurship. I hope you are keeping your commitments, baby. And here at the Haney Biz, at the Growth Factory, here on the Mark Haney Show, we're never above you, never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.